and welcome to the Partners in Fincrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name is Evan McGugan and I'm a senior manager in the Fincrime team here.
My name is Chris Vaughan and I'm a senior associate in the Fincrime team.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space.
In this episode, we welcome Tony Brown to discuss recent enforcement actions involving Coinbase as well as Al Rayan Bank. And finally, we discuss the recent changes to the threshold amount specified in POCA for Damelsors.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing?
Not too bad, Chris. Happy New Year.
And to you. How's things?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, not too bad. I think battery's sufficiently recharged after a few weeks off, so that was good. Managed to make my way through all my quality street, so now we're back into January and back into work, but it's always good to be back and have some structure to the week.
Yeah, indeed, yeah, it's nice to have a break, but back cracking on with 2023 now. So got a few things to discuss this week, I suppose, but the biggest piece is we've got a guest this week, Evan.
We do indeed. I think some listeners will be familiar with him. Certainly people who may have worked with him in the past, actually, when he was with us at FSCom, the one and only Tony Brown. Tony, welcome.
Hi, chaps. How are you?
Hello, not welcome.
Thanks very much for having me on. I feel honoured to be the very first guest. I hope I don't disappoint.
Sure you won't. As I maybe alluded to, I think a lot of the people who will be listening to this may be familiar with you, but for those who aren't, do you mind giving us a brief introduction as to who you are? What's your story?
Yeah, sure. Thanks very much, Evan. I'm Tony Brown. I've been working in financial services for coming up 20 years now. Most of that time has been spent in regulatory compliance and specifically specializing in anti-financial crime. Typical to most people, I sort of fell into the world of anti-financial crime and AML. I started working in retail banking when I was quite young, 16, back in Newcastle, where I'm from. And at the time, there was a lot of a lot of issues in banking caused from the sort of US subprime mortgage market. I was working at Newcastle Building Society at the time in the mortgages department, and you can imagine there wasn't a lot of work for us as a sort of trainee. I was kind of here and there and everywhere, did some time in the post room, for example. But one fateful day, someone called down and said there was this new team starting up called the Financial Crime Team. They were looking for people and would I be interested? And I jumped at the chance. Over the years, I kind of progressed naturally through the hierarchy, if you like, getting promotions to sort of technical roles and then manager roles and so on. I then moved to Northern Ireland in 2015, left industry, so to speak, to join PwC. So I was working in, as you can imagine, advisory and audit for some of the biggest companies in the world. I was there for best part of 4 years as a managing consultant. And I guess, you know, one of the things I found from my time there was a lot of the big banks have a lot of the same issues, right? So legacy policy, legacy systems, and backlogs in things like onboarding, periodic review. And to be totally honest with you, I got a bit bored of it all. It was quite repetitive. I then found the opportunity with FSCom to kind of come and sort of practice what I'd learned, use my experiences to date, but to focus more on the kind of fintech, alternative finance, and a little bit of crypto. And I found the work to be a lot more engaging, helping firms grow, scale, whilst also managing the sort of ever-changing world of regulation. I did that for a good while, as you know, and then I got the opportunity to come back to industry and almost practice what I've been preaching for the past 5 or 6 years. And I've taken the role at IFX. I mean, I've actually been there probably about a year and a half now, but I'm working for IFX Payments. I'm head of compliance and MLRO. And you kind of imagine what that entails, right? So sort of director of all things FinCrime. Yeah, that's I think that's the quickest I've ever done that intro, guys. So that's a good start.
It's very Very well done. Well, it's lovely to have you on the podcast. I think we were keen to have you be our first guest, mainly because listeners of the previous episodes will be aware that the intention of this podcast is to talk about topical current events in the world of anti-financial crime, anti-money laundering and everything else. Mainly because me and Chris would talk about these things at length, and certainly Tony in our time previously as sort of colleagues, and then onwards, you'd be one for that too. So it's lovely to have you on. A few things to discuss this week, and I think we're going to start as we mean to go on potentially, and we're going to start the year with something we discussed, or at least something similar to as what we discussed at the end of last year, which is a fine to kick things off. So Coinbase recently fined $50 million by the New York Department of Financial Services. Coinbase's US operation, first off, I guess it's been licensed by the NYDFS since 2017 as part of its so-called BitLicense. And in the first instance, from having read the settlement agreement, which you can find online, I would firmly recommend people give it a read. It's a very interesting read. From review of that in the first instance, the NYDFS initially found some pretty serious deficiencies in Coinbase's compliance framework across a period of about mid-2018 to the end of 2019. From this initial review, the NYDFS appointed an independent third party as an examiner, which provided a report on the issues in 2021. Coinbase then undertook remedial actions, as you'd expect, to begin to resolve the issues. Now, where those remedial actions began to fall down was that, as per the settlement agreement, Coinbase struggled really to keep up with quote unquote dramatic and unexpected growth in its business. So if you'll cast your mind back to back then, Bitcoin, for example, increased in value from something like 8K, you know, at the end of 2020, all the way up to nearly 50K sterling just over 12 months later. And the report references this, references a 15 times increase in customer signups in May 2021 when compared to the previous year, and some 25 times increase in monthly transaction volumes, which is obviously pretty significant. The effect was that by the end of 2021, the active backlog in unaction TM alerts had reached over 100,000, and there were some 14,000 customers requiring unapplied EDD at that point. So that's to set the scene. The guts of the settlement with the NYDFS is a $50 million penalty, and also an agreement to invest a further $50 million in its anti-financial crime framework. Now, I think most compliance officers, issues aside, would love $50 million, first off, to invest in their anti-financial crime framework. But I think there's a lot of pertinent themes, a lot of lessons learned, really, that you can pull out of this. And Chris, maybe I'd like to chuck it over to you at this point as FSCom's resident crypto expert. Is there anything that really jumps out at you from the settlement agreement, from the issues that were identified, that would be relevant, not just for crypto firms, but for potentially TradFi firms as well?
Yeah, definitely. Good intro. I think it's a really interesting case, and perhaps rather than looking at the exact specifics in Coinbase's case, it's sort of a bit of a cautionary tale across crypto, I think, this one, and it's sort of a jumping off point to discuss a wider issue, which is obviously keeping up with an expanding client base, first of all, and then second of all, issues that can arise when you're offering products and services using quite easy to sign up methods, EKYC, for example, and then you've got ongoing transaction monitoring in the crypto space. Obviously, one thing to be aware of for those who might not know is that you simply cannot stop incoming transactions to cryptocurrency wallets. So that's obviously something to be aware of. I think for me, I'll try to dive down into what I think is the most interesting piece here, which I think is TM, transaction monitoring. So the key piece that's come out in this is that because of the growth that Evan's just outlined there, we had, or Coinbase rather, had 100,000 unreviewed transaction monitoring alerts, and that's obviously pretty massive. That they were then using contractors, of which the work it's defined within the actual press release wasn't the best. The sheer volume itself, I think this is actually an issue that happens a lot with with crypto specifically. And I think there's something to be said for the differences with transaction monitoring than there is in sort of fiat and TradFi, which is very often with crypto, the firms are putting in place systems which are retroactive, which is a very sort of traditional way of doing things, is to look back and to see, okay, here's a pattern of transactions that occurred over a certain amount of time. Because of the nature of the cryptocurrency sort of asset class, things are so quick moving, you cannot stop incoming transactions. If you don't have systems in place that are going to be able to suspend funds or freeze funds and potentially freeze further account activity, you're going to end up with a situation in which either petty criminals or perhaps lower value crime, you know, criminal funds, let's say, or suspicious funds at least, are going to be able to be moved through accounts very, very rapidly. You'll get a deposit from potentially a dark market or something along those lines, quickly transferred out before anyone has time to investigate. And I think that that speaks volumes to actually a situation across the board in crypto, which is there needs to be systems in which firms are more proactive, I think, in terms of being able to actually stop that activity happening. I'm not saying, by the way, that Coinbase don't have that, because I don't know the specifics. I'm just using it as sort of a jumping off space to jump into a topic which I think is interesting. But yeah, for me, I think there's a number of things. So there's quick and easy KYC. Sometimes there's not enough KYC done, to be honest, when it's eKYC, when you're just providing an ID and perhaps a selfie. And then you've got the TM feeding into that. And what you end up doing accidentally in some cases is actually attracting bad actors who want to offload their suspicious crypto. And they're well aware that firms have blockchain monitoring now. But as soon as deficiencies are found, that's going to be exploited by an unknown number of bad actors in the space, really. So yeah, that's the key things. I think, I don't know if any thoughts from you, Evan, or perhaps Tony, have you got any sort of further insights there?
I suppose what I would add at this point, lads, is like, this isn't a new problem, right? So Coinbase have been kind of the most recent and we're using them as an example, but it's just another example of firms growing beyond their means, right? And it's happened time and time again, and we've seen the same issues repeat themselves. So a company starts off, it goes live, it does what it does, and then all of a sudden they find that the sort of volume of new customers, the volume of particularly payments, has grown beyond their means. And I kind of, you know, there's no, you know, I should probably caveat here, views on my own. I'm not dissing anybody particularly, but I find it quite strange that another firm has allowed this to happen. And as I obviously can't comment specifically about Coinbase, but I can kind of draw comparisons from my own world. So obviously IFX Payments, I kind of didn't do a proper intro as to who we are and what we do, but we're a kind of typical fintech. We offer multi-currency wallets. We're an EMI, so issue e-money wallets in multiple currencies for companies that have global currency needs, global payment needs, essentially, right? So we ourselves are going through a sort of period of rapid growth. And I suppose I can only say, you know, from my experience, what I've found to be the kind of starting point for all this is we all, how many times we say this risk-based approach, but what is that? Well, for me, it starts off with a proper risk assessment. So firms are very good, right, at going, we are going to do payments. We know that whenever we process a payment, there's a risk of money laundering. So we kind of put it all down in a tabular format and we say, here's the risks and here's what we've got. But that's just lip service, right? Does anyone actually go in and make sure that they have, and this is my turn of phrase that Evan loves, the people, the process, and the technology to be able to do that business. And at IFX, you know, we're at the minute, we're working on our operational resilience plan, which I think has been very insightful. I think it's a brilliant exercise, actually. And one of the things that I'm doing as part of this piece of work is essentially, you know, testing the real facts behind that risk assessment. So we say we do onboarding, but what exactly does that entail? What do we do? How do we do it? How long does it take? And really, I suppose quantifying risk through fact, does that, if you're following us, I don't know if I'm kind of rambling a bit, but I guess you know, you can have all the risk assessments in the world, but until you have real data and real business, these things just kind of sit dormant until you have a problem. So I guess one of the things that I've been doing, and Coinbase, as I say, is just another example, is stress testing those theories and say, if we suddenly did 50% more business, can we stand up? And it's very naive to say that, you know, you're dependent on resource, i.e. humans, people, to do the business, because that's not scalable and it costs a lot of money, and to throw people at issues isn't the best way to do it. So to summarize, I think it's I think we're long past firms kind of going, oh, we didn't realize we were going to be this big and now we've got a load of backlogs. I think you've got to be a lot more strategic, and you've got to plan for these things to happen.
Yeah, I think that's really important, actually. The business should be completely in your control as well. So you don't have to take on new customers if you're not in a position where you can't actually, you know, conduct the correct due diligence, where you can't put customers, potential new customers, through the correct processes, or they're going to end up in some huge backlog. You don't have to accept new business. You know, it's purely a decision, and we understand the business pressures, like, it's obvious, but it should all be controlled, as you say, and you should have that sort of resilience there. So yeah, I think that's a really valuable point.
Yeah, it also begs the question to everybody, to anybody who's listening to this, is, do you have thresholds, do you have controls and MI in your business that starts to go to sort of amber and if not red lights when you are coming to capacity? And when I say capacity, that is, do you have the resource and your human hours in the day to continue your business as it is, let alone find me a business that doesn't want to grow, that doesn't want to have more clients, more payments, more revenues. And certainly, as I say, that's a practice that I've started, you know, the first week back in the new year. That's something that we're doing at IFX, is if we suddenly, you know, multiply our current, you know, new business by, you know, say 50%, what does that mean? Ultimately, it always goes, well, we need more bums on seats, we need more people. But actually, that's not necessarily the right approach. And especially as a fintech, we really should be looking at utilizing these sort of reg techs and other controls out there to make sure that doesn't become a problem, you know?
Yeah. And another thing, because that's, I think that's a great point, but it speaks to what I was saying earlier around transaction monitoring. Like, very often you'll find firms use third parties. In Coinbase's case, they actually built their own blockchain monitoring tools so that they have an in-house version. But if you are using a third party, which is more common in the marketplace, have you stress tested that? Do you understand what volumes are going to look like? Have you got good insights into the kind of, you know, have you done testing of the rules themselves? If there were to be an influx of, like you were mentioning, are your transaction monitoring rules going to suddenly create thousands of false you're going to be able to deal with? You know, what's your response there, I suppose? So, yeah, I think that's...
Well, you know, I like my metaphors, but one of the things that I've said recently is, if you have a leaky bucket, you don't fill it with more water to try and, you know, resolve the fact that you're sort of losing that volume, right? You focus on the hole and try and find a cause. And actually, then it begs the question is, well, do you have the right bucket in the first place? Do you not need to use something else? And you know, without going down that train of thought too much, I think that, you know, certainly the takeaway that I've had from operational resilience is certainly that's the exercise. It's kind of looking at exactly what you're doing today with a view of what, you know, you've done historically, and make sure that's fit for purpose. And again, at the risk of repeating myself, one of the things that people need to do is use real data, right? Because everything that we do is tends to be ifs, buts, and maybes. We think this might happen or this could happen, and that's just a risk assessment. That is that static document that I said, and it doesn't actually mean anything until it's too late, more often than not. And unfortunately for Coinbase, they've found themselves in this place.
I think it always comes back to qualitative versus quantitative, doesn't it? Particularly when it comes to whole firm risk assessments, we see it time and time again. But as you say, having that all singing, all dancing description of what we would do in the ideal world versus what happens if something manifests or crystallizes, it is quite different. Love the reference to people, process, technology too. it always comes down to that, right? And that really feeds into that scalability point too. I think, you know, the the times 15 or the times 25 growth in business over a year is obviously wild and something most businesses would struggle with. Most businesses would dream of having to have that issue to have to try and deal with. But and Chris, you mentioned the hiring of all the contractors too, and maybe it goes to that point of getting the water out of the bucket and not just when the issues have manifested. So jumping on now to where Coinbase found itself after it all crystallized, but resisting that temptation to just chuck people at the problem it is definitely something that can and should be learned out of this. Once you find yourself in that situation where you maybe have a remediation to be undertaking, the report itself, as you said, actually talks around the contractors being provided training that wasn't scalable, maybe not even tracking attendance of that training, and actually specifically quotes something along the lines of a substantial portion of the action that these contractors were doing was rife with errors. So again, training, people, process, technology, where an issue manifests, avoid that temptation just to throw bodies at it. And if you have to deal with a remediation or some sort of look back effort, it's vitally important that that's well planned, it's well tracked, resources well trained. But even generally, yeah, we hark on it time and time again, but be it for internal staff or external resource, the importance of adequate training cannot be understated. People, process, technology. If the scalability is impossible due to unprecedented business growth, then, you know, people, process, technology, it all has to be 100% or it's all going to fall down.
Well, in this case, rather than have a leaking bucket and putting more water in, they've had an overflowing bucket and not known what the hell to do with it, you know. So that's you can choose which analogy you want. But, I think history repeats itself and it happens time and time again. And as I say, as a sector, as an industry, we're far too evolved now, far too mature now to be seeing the same mistakes repeated over and over again. And certainly, you know, the feeling that I get would be that the regulator will probably start to treat these things more and more severely, right? Because there's more than enough examples out there of firms doing this badly. And, you know, the excuses quickly run out. You know, oh, we've had too much, we've got backlogs. It's firms especially that have a lot of, you know, these guys aren't that new, you know, that crypto's a sort of a evolving thing, as we all know, but ultimately you're still a payments company in some description, you're still regulated, you still should have these things. These are all AML 101, FCA, you know, handbook 101. You clearly have the technology, but you didn't have the resource to back it up. And what causes these backlogs? Probably having poor processes and policies in the front end. So the things go round and round, and all things are as equally important as one another. But yeah, feel bad for them. Like it's not a nice place to be.
Absolutely. So moving on potentially from one fine to the next. And I'm sort of cognizant of time, so I'll maybe very quickly set the scene. But as of the time of recording, 2 days ago to where we speak today, on the 11th of January, 2023, the FCA penalised Al Rayan Bank PLC for failures with respect to anti-money laundering framework. And in short, between the period of 2015 and 2017, the bank allowed money to pass through it and be used within the UK without carrying out appropriate checks. By appropriate checks, what do I mean? Well, predominantly, the firm failed to adequately check its customer source of wealth and source of funds to ensure that they weren't involved in one way or another with illicit activity. Final notice, again, very interesting reading. Chris, I know you particularly found some interest in a section of the final notice that speaks to source of wealth, source of funds, and potentially what the FCA expects of firms when it comes to fulfilling those checks. These final notices are so valuable for that, because you actually get to see what the regulator identifies to be good and bad practice. So, yeah, Chris, do you have any statements, any thoughts that you'd like to make on the contents of that final notice?
Yeah, definitely. I think it actually opens up a topic for discussion, which I think is interesting, which is EDD in general, and then more specifically source of funds, source of wealth. So I think everyone sort of, you know, in the compliance space is going to know that a higher risk equals more due diligence. So your enhanced due diligence procedures are often going to include either you know, getting some information on the source of funds or the source of wealth of a client, but then sometimes it will also, depending on the situation and using a risk-based approach, it might also be pertinent to gather documentation to back that up as well. And I just think that taking, perhaps not speaking to the actual fine specifically, but I do think that what's come out of this is quite interesting, and it's around when should that be conducted, first of all? When do we identify a higher risk? And then once we've identified that higher risk, when do we apply these measures? And should customers be able to continue to use products and services while this happens? Should this always be done at an onboarding stage? And if it isn't, and if there are changes, then I think the evolving nature of risk is that obviously there will always be changes. How do you respond to that then going forward? So, you know, there are numerous different situations in which this could happen. But for example, let's say a jurisdictional risk change, for example, you know, changes to either Schedule 3ZA of the MLRs, which is you know, HM Treasury's list of high-risk third countries, or you've got FATF changes, that them two are mirrored, and then you've got potentially EU high-risk third countries as well. These are changing all the time, and the risk is ever evolving. So if that has an effect on your customer base as it stands, if there's new measures that need to be introduced, when do you conduct those measures? And I think that for me, that's a really interesting piece. And I think it seems to me, reading through this particular notice, is that we should really be very rigorous about this at onboarding, and it shouldn't be a sort of afterthought. It should be an upfront determination, quite thorough risk assessment, which would then result in further questions being asked. And yeah, specifically source of funds, source of wealth. Understanding what the difference between them are, I think, is really important as well. I think very often you'll find that it's quite difficult to actually elucidate what the difference is and what do we mean. And then what is appropriate documentation? So for source of funds, you know, okay, how is a customer going to fund an account? But source of wealth is very different to that. And it isn't just always a document. Sometimes just a document doesn't actually tell you that much, and actually counterintuitively, sometimes information can be more pertinent, and a definitely external research as well, I think, as well, to understand the risk and the situation better. I don't know if Tony, have you got thoughts there around this? Because I think it's really a misunderstood and sort of misapprehended topic, and I think it's a really interesting one. So yeah
I certainly do. And again, I've kind of preached about this at many events in the past, but I think, again, well, like, a starting point for this, it really is, and again, apologies for sort of preaching, but onboarding customers, right, for me, is less about collecting documents for the sake of collecting them and more about asking proper questions, right? So customer onboarding, who do they say they are and what do they say they do? That's ultimately what I kind of advise our kind of sales guys to go out and understand. And it comes back to that point, Chris, is who they say they are. You can very rarely get that from things like MEMS and ARTS and incorporation documents, right? It is speaking to humans and speaking to people and asking them. One of the things that we're getting better at IFX is understanding the business. So what do you do? Like, what are the services or products you sell? Who are your types of clients? You know, this narrative is a hell of a lot more powerful than collecting documentation, right? So to pivot off that source of funds and source of wealth, if I use an example of a private individual to start with, for me, a source of wealth for a private individual, how have you accumulated your global assets? So if you're a successful business person, you know, it's about building almost a bio, like, this person went to this university, they started this business, they sold it in, you know, this year for this much money, they've reinvested that here and here. It gets a little bit trickier for an organization, but I've always tended to lean on source of wealth of an entity, of a company, is the initial capital that was put in to start the business. And the question being, has that derived from a criminal, you know, starting point? And then generally speaking, source of wealth for a business is profits from successful business, right? So you know, one of the things that we will do is look at things like you know, financial statements, audited financial statements, where we can get them to see, you know, does it line up? So source of wealth for a starting point is has the person or the entity's wealth derived from criminal activity. Source of funds then is an extension of that, and that's, does the source of funds, i.e. is the origination of this particular payment that we're looking at, has that or could that have derived from crime? And I think you're right. I think technically, you know, from what I've seen, you know, in my time in the sort of audit space and various roles in industry, is there is a lot more comfort and a lot more knowledge on how to handle source of funds, i.e. we need to know what this permit is, oh, here's an invoice or here's a whatever. And a lack of knowledge and understanding of how to quantify that source of wealth. And the pivot is, all these things again shouldn't be static, right? So who you say you are and what you say you do should add up over a period of continued time, continued business. And where we need to then, you know, look at things from a kind of AML CTF perspective is when the actual activity doesn't add up versus what we perceived the activity to be. And that's where source of funds and source of wealth are just super powerful and really are, you know, that is for me the crux of AML. And again, you know, I say this with a smile on my face that the listeners can't see, but, you know, that shouldn't be that hard, you know, especially if your upfront questions are meaningful.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's an interesting one between the individual and the entity as well. So there's circumstances like, for example, high-risk third countries, there's obviously a requirement to apply EDD in the UK, you know, speaking specifically to the UK regs. But the source of funds, source of wealth requirement is information on the source of funds, source of wealth of the entity and of the beneficial owner, which is that almost both in some cases, because sometimes you will need the source of funds, source of wealth for the entity, but then in the case where the beneficial owner is an individual or ultimate beneficial owner in some cases, most cases will be, taking that extra step then to think, okay, what further questions or documentation might we need here in that circumstance?
Yeah. And here's another challenge, right? So for a brand new entity or, you know, recently incorporated entity, technically the source of wealth, by my definition, is the capital that's put in to essentially float the shares, which can often be like a couple of quid. So that doesn't really stack up. And that then goes into the wider question, well, who are the people behind this business and where has their wealth come from? Because more often than not, that's the secret source, right?
I think that's fantastic. I think, you know, if you sort of poke your way through the final notice, I'm going to sort of tie it back to my point on Coinbase, actually, to make it nice and pretty. But training, you know, the final notice talks specifically around the fact that guidance was not sufficiently provided to staff to be able to make these determinations. And, you know, I think it's all well and good for us to sit in this room right now and discuss quite technical points as to what may be considered to be source of funds for an individual, for a corporate, the different variations therein. And this is obviously a conversation that we can maybe have, but if you don't then provide the guidance to be able to empower your staff to be able to make these decisions themselves, to make those determinations without having to go up the ladder, then you're going to be fighting a losing battle to begin with. And I really like the point you made earlier, Chris, on, you know, the sort of counterintuitive aspects of where documentation may or may not be good versus information. The regulatory requirement when dealing with source of funds and source of wealth is to verify source of funds and source of wealth. And as we know, we have to do that on the basis of information or documentation, which is reliable and independent of the customer. But verify it. Don't just go get a bank statement and think you're done. When it comes to source of funds, don't just get, you know, proof of sale unless it actually makes sense with respect to the nature and purpose, with respect to client relationship. And equally, do not be afraid of open source research when it comes to source of wealth verification, because that's, you know, that's where the good stuff is.
Yeah, well, a good example of that, Evan, is most of our source of wealth is a bio, which is built solely from public research and or speaking to the people behind the business directly. It's very rare that we have documentation that, you know, evidences source of wealth. It's usually, as I say, you know, this company was set up on this date. It was being funded by X and Y. You know, they had a sale of shares in this. Yeah, that raised more capital, which was put into the business. That for me is a lot more relevant and a lot more useful than any amount of documentation that you can hold on a system. And that goes hand in hand, funny enough, with source of funds. So we've had an alert triggered because it's going to a high risk business. So we write out and we get an invoice that says it's the same amount as what we're seeing. But actually the value in that from a true AML perspective is looking at who's the beneficiaries or where are the funds coming from. Does that make sense that this company is paying our client? Does that make sense based on what we understand their products and services to be? And I can give you a real example that I was looking at this week. We had raised queries around an import-export business for various reasons, but mostly because it was hitting our TM systems. And they provide us with a bank statement. And in that bank statement is tons of payments, and like a lot, like hundreds of payments coming in and out for small numbers, so like hundreds of pounds rather than thousands, from private individuals. So the question there is, why on earth is an import-export business receiving lots of small transactions from individuals? That does not make sense. And our concerns were that this was involved in an investment scam. So clearly it did not add up from a kind of source of funds perspective. That's not typical behavior of an import-export business. And secondly, we already kind of had some suspicions of investment type fraud. So by actually stopping and not just going, okay, we've got a question, let's fill that hole with a document, save it down, and then we're all good. It's actually about reading the documents provided and seeing if it makes sense in context to the payment, and probably more importantly, in context to what we know about our client.
Yeah, 100%. And how can you can't always rely on invoices as well. You know, that invoices can be very hit and miss in terms of the information provided and how reliable they actually are. Not to open a complete other sort of can of worms here, but thinking about source of funds, source of wealth in the crypto space as well is also super challenging. You know, how are we going to verify, let's say, wallet ownership in some cases? How are we going to take steps to understand, you know, in the crypto space, the people who just got in early, for example, with Bitcoin, with such a volatile asset like that, it's not going to be the standard kinds of documentation from that you would see in TradFi. It's very different. So it's another challenging aspect there, I think. Not to dive into that in too much detail. But Evan, I think we've got one last piece that we want to cover off for the day, right?
We do. I think we'd probably be remiss if we didn't point it out. But essentially, it's the change to the threshold amount, the statutory change to the threshold amount specified in POCA 2002. So by that I mean essentially the threshold amounts of value by which, you know, criminal property below which a relevant person is able to carry out a transaction or, you know, make a payment without committing one of the main money laundering offenses under, you know, section 327 and 329. So in short, the value beyond which a DAML SAR is required. Previously, it was 250 sterling. Now, it's 1,000. This relates, to deposit taking bodies, so credit institutions, EMIs, APIs. Chris, I don't know if you want to quickly remind everybody, you know, what a DAML SAR is.
Yeah, indeed. So this is an interesting piece of legislation, I suppose. DAML SAR has been intended for asking for consent, which is what they used to be called, consent SARs, from the NCA to carry out an act which might be one of the money laundering offences, basically. So in real terms, in terms of practical terms, this is usually where funds are frozen on an account, for example, that you are suspicious about. And then you may go to the NCA and say, look, here we've got this account and these funds that we're suspicious about, and we want nothing to do with them. Perhaps we want to reject the funds, but in doing so and handling suspicious funds, we might carry out a money laundering offence. And then you go to the NCA and you say, okay, these are the situation. You request a defence SAR, which is a specific checkbox that can be done within the SAR portal, and then you have to wait basically before the NCA comes back to you and tells you what to do about it. So the increase in the threshold here being from the lower threshold of 250 up to 1,000 basically means that the NCA are going to focus their concerns on cases that are a higher value and that might be more impactful for money laundering purposes. So I think in most cases, I would say probably especially probably for sort of retail products and services. This is good news, I think, really, and it's going to be good.
Yeah, seems probably more in line with how the modern payments fintech ecosystem seems to operate. It'll definitely reduce the workload that the NCA has to deal with respect to Damo SARS. That's obviously a good thing for them and for law enforcement and morally in that sense. You'd be expecting a reduction certainly in the amount of DAMLs that they'll receive, which I think at last check, if I remember, they received around, was it 500,000? Granted, DAML and non-DAMLs, but 500,000 SARS last year, which is pretty mad. Bad thing potentially might be the potential reduction in the amount of intelligence provided to law enforcement, if that were to manifest in some way or another. Be interesting to think about what this means for the firm. And Tony, obviously wouldn't ask you to talk specifics around SOAR. How do you see this as affecting things? Do you think this is a positive move? Do you think it'll unclog the pipe somewhat, lead to maybe a bit less operational workload? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably quite controversial. So again, just to reiterate points on my own, I think for all intents and purposes, the NCA is a finite resource and quite commonly known to be under-resourced. We'll not get into the reasons why, but don't want to be too political. But, you know, if they have finite resources, put simply, they have to focus on the bigger issues, right? So these are the organized crime gangs. These are the, you know, global financial crime, I don't know, businesses, if you like, you know, professional money launderers. And a couple of hundred pound SAR is not necessarily gonna add to their ability to combat that. I suppose I've spoken in the past as well, like, does that make a massive operational difference to us? Probably it does. Less, you know, generic reporting. But one of the things that I'm quite proud of at IFX is we do have a good team. We have a very experienced team that work in that space. And it's, for me, it's more about quality of information that we provide, right? So I've said this in the past. When we submit suspicious activity reports, first and foremost, they tend to be linked to genuine suspicion, i.e. here's some information and here's why we're suspicious. Again, going back to the point I made earlier, because we have a perception of who our clients are and what they told us they do, and that hasn't stacked up for a specific reason. And more importantly, what we put into those SARs is I've told my team, when we're submitting a SAR, don't put something in it that you wouldn't be happy delivering yourself to a police officer. There should be information on who these people are, where we think they're based, the accounts in question, and more importantly, these things should pivot off the purpose, i.e. why we're suspicious. So I can only speak for myself. I think, you know, practically, yes, there'll be less DAMLs, less, you know, smaller payments going through the system for the sake of it, but it doesn't necessarily impact a company that's quite strong on the who, what, why, when, how, when it comes to reporting. Again, that might be completely stupid to say, because as we know, lots and lots and lots of payments of 200 quid adds up to a big number quite quickly. But is it really worth a finite investigator, you know, base looking into lots of small payments when they're actually looking for the big guys?
No, it's a really good point. Actually, it might help the defensive reporters out there, but if you're receiving good quality internal SARs at this point, and particularly big ticket items, it may not change that much. I've seen a lot of discussion on LinkedIn on this topic over the past week. I think it's important to remember that whilst the threshold may have changed to 1,000, it's not 250 anymore. The lack of a requirement to file a DAML shouldn't really lead to any change in very much of anything. It shouldn't lead to change to your risk appetite or acceptance of activity. It just means you're not going to be holding something for 7 days before you can pay it on. So if something would have been a DAML before, you're still looking to go through your processes, exiting, rejecting, documenting, audit trail, whatever the case may be. And you still may want to do an information SAR if you need to.
Yeah, and by the way, anyone who's listening, that does not mean that you don't have to monitor for anything under the threshold. You still absolutely do. I don't want this coming back to me somehow, and I'm sure you guys don't. But I think that's a powerful point. And you know, again, I've been quite critical, actually, of fellow professionals in our space who will submit a DAML for the sake of submitting a DAML. Like, that is not the purpose here. Don't just do what you want and report it and go, oh, well, they never came back, so we're okay. If that's financial crime, you are still on the hook for it. So be mindful. And I suppose for me, it's the takeaway from that is think about the purpose. What are you reporting, and is it of relevance? Can somebody do something with what you've reported? Could it lead to an investigation? Or are you doing it just because, oh, I'm not really sure, so I'm just going to tick DML and then assume that it's okay? That's counterintuitive.
It really is legitimately, literally tick box compliance.
Exactly.
Chris, do you have any thoughts on this? Any additional thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, I suppose I'll just reiterate what you guys have already said, really, which is obviously that it's not a change that will necessarily, or shouldn't necessarily change the way you do things, but it is something to be aware of. Should be looking to review policies and procedures around your DAML processes where relevant. And yeah, I suppose if anything, it should just be a reminder to have another think about the situations in which you might need to change some little pieces of your framework, but nothing fundamental. So no, nothing really to add. I think it's probably a great place to wrap this up for this week.
Perfect. Fantastic. Well, gents, I think that was a really enjoyable discussion for myself anyway. Hopefully it's an enjoyable listen. Tony, thanks for taking the time out of what I'm sure is a busy calendar to join the podcast. We'll maybe see you again in future episodes at some point.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Perfect. Well, I hope everybody enjoys what remains of their day. See you later.
Cheers. Bye.
Thanks, bye.